Chris Stone, aka Galley, is the head coach for the United States Olympic surf team. His qualifications for that role came from years spent on tour traveling with and coaching Jordy Smith and the Hobgoods before him, as well as many other notable athletes as they make their way to the World Championship Tour. As a professional surfer, Stone qualified for the CT in 1995. He was the first surfer from Santa Cruz to do so. While on tour, he won the Margaret River Pro, he won the Coldwater Classic twice back-to-back, and he got second at G-Land. Since retiring from pro surfing, he relocated to the North Shore and began shaping surfboards, raising a family, and helped usher in this era of the professional surf coach, hence his new role with the Olympics. So in this chat, we cover most of what you'll need to know about surfing in the Olympics. He addresses whether or not surfing in the Olympics is even good for surfing at large. He advises on how to make an objective judging criteria. He comments on Jordy's title run this year, as well as Jordy's greatest areas for improvement. And he also details the quiver that Galley's been working on this entire year for Jordy. So my name is David Scales for Surf Splendor. Here's my conversation with surfboard shaper and Olympic head coach, Chris Stone. I hope that you enjoy. So, tell me, what's your role with the Olympics?
I am the head coach for the United States Olympic team, hired by USA Surfing. And that entails going to, you know, the big ISA events that all the elites go to. And just all the, you know, the minutiae that goes along with a sport getting bigger. You know, there's a lot more interviews and podcasts and, you know, a lot more talking and summits and different things you kind of got to go through to kind of learn the whole ins and outs of something that is a lot bigger than going to a WCT event.
And I would imagine you're considering that it's really the first time surfing's been in the Olympics, or that it is the first time, you're probably responsible for helping kind of craft that vision, right?
Yeah, and that's sort of the trick is what is that vision, you know, and try to have that crystal ball is a hard one, and trying to anticipate how it looks with these high level $1 million athletes all kind of getting together and what that dynamic looks like and how I work with their coaches and how the performance program works and how that ties in with the USOC, how the WSL and the IOC and the USOC and all these different organizations work together to come up with the judges, the judging, the format. How does that all look? So yeah, there's a lot to digest and a lot of unknowns. So you just kind of gotta learn, a lot of learning.
I'm curious what the main challenges are, and then secondly, what is the format gonna look like? How is it gonna be different than what we're accustomed to?
The challenges are everybody's schedule is a challenge, and trying to make everybody happy, which you're never really going to do. You know, this is another thing. I mean, they have to do these ISAs to be eligible and to qualify, and just getting them together for any kind of performance thing or any kind of meeting or anything. And these are busy people, you know, and there's a lot going on. Their schedules are pretty tight. And things pop up that they have to do, and things for their sponsors. And, you know, it's an individual sport. People aren't used to it being a team, at least for a very long time, if they did do the ISAs back in the day when they were amateurs and stuff. So those are some challenges. And then I forgot your second part of the question.
In regard to when they run the event itself, how will it be different than what we're accustomed to with the WSL?
and that is to be decided. Okay. I actually ran into Eric Kramer, who's also a coach. He's part of the technical team that's working on these things and working out the formats and working out. And so it's interesting because they went for a 20 person. It doesn't break down very well, and they want to have as much man on man as possible. But it's kind of tough to break it down with a 20 man. But they're looking at a lot of things. I think they've reached out to the WSL of any old formats they've gone over and looked at, and trying to kind of come up with the best way to come up with a gold medalist.
What do you think the biggest potential area for improvement in the format is over what we currently see on the WSL?
Wow, I mean, that's a big question. I mean, man-on-man is exciting, and you saw that when the wave pool happened, that it kind of took a lot of that strategy, the last minute this, the ins and outs of the man-on-man competition. There's a lot to digest, you know. It's kind of like, the more you know about man-on-man competition, it's sort of like baseball, right? The more you know about baseball, the funner it gets to watch, because you kind of, you know, can, there's so much going on with the strategy and the different things. And so it's hard to say what would be better than man on man. I think the ultimate would be a cumulative format where it's multiple rounds over days, and you round robin, everyone surfs against different people with a leaderboard, and you know, and a lot of times people give arguments like, oh, the conditions change or this or that, but I think it would be better, and better is always better, right? Even though there's going to be issues with conditions and such, cumulative things seem to work better for, you know, sports that have a lot of variables. It might get a little boring because it would probably be the same couple people in the top.
I know.
You know?
I mean, it's a tremendous amount of pressure to get it right.
It is. It is. There's, it's tricky. It's a, what makes surfing so magical for all of us that are involved and just becomes our life is also makes it hard to package up and sell and you know, because you've got this performance art, basically, you know, trying to package it up as a sport with the ocean and Mother Nature, and every wave's different, and here comes the wind and there's the tides, and it's really difficult in that way. And so what the wave pools solve, it also takes away a little bit of the excitement. What a cumulative format solves, it also takes away a little bit of the excitement of the man-on-man, the cutthroat, the underdog. So, maybe there could be both, you know?
Yeah.
You have this mix, and you know, for different spots, and overlapping formats, pretty cool, but people can kind of get skunked, and you're blocking people in the heat next to you, and maybe he's next to you in the rankings, and you just focus on blocking him if you've lost. And there's all sorts of things that could go on, and like I said, it's surfing. You know, it's hard. It's a slippery little pig, you know, hard to get your hands on and package it up.
In an ideal scenario, if we're going to be debuting surfing in the Olympics, you know, it'd be great to see it at Pipeline in December or something like that. Clearly, that's not what we're going to have in Japan.
Yep.
How do you feel about the venue and the time of year and the way that it's ultimately going to be debuted? Do you feel optimistic about it?
I think you have to feel optimistic. I mean, we're in the Olympics. I mean, who would have thought this, you know, 25 years ago, 30 years, even 10 years ago, you know, a lot of people thought Fernando was like, you're never going to get this in the Olympics, you know, and how do you do it? And, there should be waves. We'll get, if there's waves in the first 8 days, we'll get good TV time. If we get in the last, we won't get as much. And so it's, hopefully we can get some swell at the beginning and really promote it. But I'm not sure if the waves are really the story. You know, it's really about the athletes promoting the sport in the right way, getting the personalities in there, and kind of educating people on what surfing's about, and showcasing. You know, you could do, I mean, obviously Red Bull and NBC and these people do these crazy documentaries and these different pieces and these bios on people that are incredible to watch. And seeing the inside, I mean, everybody's got a crazy story,
yeah.
You know, and everybody's had crazy experiences on the tour and archival footage, and you know, there's an opportunity to, you know, to not, if the 1 foot Japan isn't the show, then there's other ways to kind of make surfing look great, which hasn't been done really that well if you think about it. You know,
yeah.
It's a lot of money to send people around. It would just be another cost for the WSL if there was just these bios on everybody. That would make it twice as interesting for the people that aren't hardcore fans. But
yeah.
Again, that's What are you going to go spend $150,000-$200,000 for every single athlete on the tour to do this incredible bio on them? So these are the resources that NBC has, that the Olympics have, that we don't have in the past. And I mean, but again, there's going to be athletes that look amazing in those types of waves. In that time of year, there is pretty consistent wind swell, and we've got a pretty big window to run, I believe, a two-and-a-half-day event, pick and choose with tides and such. And so hopefully they can, you know, dress it up and we get lucky. You know, there's barrels at different times and really good surf that time of year. I think, you know, maybe if surfing's got some pretty good karma, maybe it'll get some surf.
Good. I mean, I guess you're right. When I watch the Olympics, I really know nothing about most of the sports that I watch. And it's all about how they package it and sell the athletes and their mm-hmm. stories mm-hmm. that get me invested. Yep. And then I will watch their run or whatever it is and mm-hmm. kind of have a moderate amount of interest in mm-hmm. how they perform, but it yep. is more the story. So I guess you're right.
Yeah, I hope I am. You know, we all know how incredible surfing is, and people think it's easy until they try it. You know, yeah. these top athletes finally get on a surfboard and go, that is the hardest thing I've ever tried. And, over time, I think that instead of it being this fringe kind of sport, it'll be recognized as this thing where, you know, only the freakiest of athletes really excel at this. And, you know, and that seems to be the truth. You know, you see these athletes and they all kind of got that look in their eye. You know what I mean? They look like astronauts or, you know, Formula One, racers, or, you know what I mean? There's something different about a high level surfer that, you can't quite put your finger on.
Yeah. So we have a 16-day window to run 2.5 days of competition.
I'm not exactly sure how the format looks, but it's only 40 people altogether, so okay. it shouldn't take, you know, too long.
Okay.
Overall. But again, the format hasn't been decided.
Who are the judges going to be? How do they vet them out?
The ISOC, I mean, the IOC has its sort of regulations as far as how the judging has to be, you know, like kind of in their own little box, and they can't talk to each other, and which is very different than how it is on the WCT or a lot of different panels around the world. I know that the ISAs have tried to kind of lean going that direction. So it'd be good if all the judging around the world mimicked each other and sort of create this standard, and there was training and there was all these other things. But, you know, that's been a concern of a lot of people, is how does that look? There needs to be more of an international panel. And, you know, if you consider some of the best in the world don't get it right sometimes, you know, it might be a bit of a challenge to follow those regulations and still get, you know, a fair result. But
seems like the biggest area for improvement over the WSL, like being able to start from scratch with the judging. I mean, the judging, you know, year to year on the WSL is the one thing that the internet kind of questions the most. Mm-hmm. It's very hard,
yes,
to come up with like an objective standard for how we should view and judge surfing. But considering that there's all that criticism for the WSL from year to year, that would be the biggest area of opportunity for the Olympics to do something radically different and mm-hmm. potentially nail it.
Yeah, I think at some point there needs to be a way to hand judges tools that they can use and come up with more of a degree of difficulty scale that is usable and digestible for them. It's how the athletes want to be scored and judged. And, it should be up to the athletes. It should be this kind of moving sort of list of where you're sort of rating maneuvers and different things. And so, you know, 'cause if you go and argue a score, it's like just the way that the criteria is structured, there's a get out of jail free card at any point.
Totally.
With it. And so if there was more of a standard where you could walk up to and go, degree of difficulty scale, guys, I just got beat by two windshield wipers and I'm doing full wraps with release on my forehand and I've got more variety and I went for a little air on the inside, and you're telling me that this backside stab up into the lip just because it throws spray, it's not more difficult because we've got it right here on our difficulty scale. And just more tools where there is some sort of recourse if there is a question decision. And and there's more tools for them to use as they're breaking down waves. I mean, if you watch two backhand waves back to back, you know, how do you differentiate, really? If it's all kind of repetitive, well, one might have some carve in it to release, one might have a bit deeper rail, maybe there's more variety. But if it's all kind of backhand snaps, you know, it becomes very technical at a certain point. But the best, most difficult surfing should win, and sometimes it doesn't.
Do you think that there is a way to actually solve that equation? Can you create an objective criteria that says degree of difficulty, like these things are harder to do than those things?
I'm not sure, but I don't see anybody trying. You know what I mean? I see the judges in their own world creating their own standards, and it's not as if they're not knowledgeable, but there's a whole industry filled with people that have surfed for 40, 50 years each that could help kind of draft something up. And again, the athletes understand what's difficult. They understand what's hard. They understand, and you know, and it comes down to two, like, what would the athlete rather be doing? You know, if you ask an athlete, like, well, I would way rather done that deep freaking gouge right over there than that little flick out of the lip through spray. So, you know, just having some sort of like, this is what's hard, this is what's kind of hard, this is what's easy, and you have some sort of recourse if you're walking up there, because it's in black and white. It's right there in the degree of difficulty scale. And how did I get beat by this when I'm doing this? Then they could say, well, you dug a little there. It wasn't that deep. Your angle of attack was low. It wasn't that risky. You could argue either way, but at least there's some kind of way to kind of, you know, have an, you know, they have tools and you have an understanding about what you're trying to accomplish. You know, if you think about the layback, it's kind of one of the easiest maneuvers in surfing. Score is gigantic, right? The backside wiper is back big time, and that's probably the easiest maneuver in surfing, at least one that scores really well. And I think differentiating between, you know, stuff like that, and you kind of shoot yourself in the foot too if you're a coach. You're just like, well, my guy's so big on the layback, why would I open my mouth? But everybody understands that it's sort of training wheels, that it's easier. It gets you off your back foot. It's almost impossible to slide out. The nose comes out of the water. It's not difficult in comparison to setting your rail, pulling it all the way around, or releasing the tail. I mean, my thing is always, if there's no rail and no release, there's no risk. That's kind of how I look at it.
As you're seeing it all come together,
yeah.
Do you feel confident that the Olympics will get it correct enough to where you can really feel like it's a step in the right direction? There's a million variables that can go wrong.
There is. You would have to have like 7 crystal balls to kind of know what's going to happen. This is definitely like a wait and see. I'm going to be optimistic because surfing always seems to be a success in spite of itself, in spite of who's running it, in spite of who's judging it, in spite of, you know, the sponsorship leaving and the hard, you know, have to package it up is difficult. It always seems to succeed and kind of overcome these things. So I'm going to be optimistic. And I mean, look, we hear from lots of people through this experience, you know, with the USOC and the different people we've talked to, that first year sports, it's kind of a S show, you know what I mean? I guess I can kind of cuss on this, can I?
You can. It doesn't matter.
It's a shit show for the most part, and that means that there's so many unknowns and so many variables, and the NGBs are brand new, national governing bodies. They're brand new. They're trying to, like, figure out how to run this thing. You go to the Olympics, the accreditation's wild. It's huge. The opening ceremonies, like, there's a lot of variables, and then you've got, you know, all these sort of non-endemic, you know, sponsorships, non-endemic TV companies trying to come in, and what's, you know, I think NBC was smart enough to hire Red Bull to help do some work for them to try to get it right. You know, surfing's pretty amazing. It's kind of hard to geek it up. It's pretty cool.
Yeah. You know? What's your hope? I mean, for obviously you want USA to win gold, but
yes,
kind of for the bigger picture for surfing, obviously the crusty local in the Beach Grit comment section or whatever will always argue for not making surfing bigger. Like,
Yeah.
It's just going to be more crowded next year when I try to surf. So let's not actually grow down this path.
Yeah.
What's your ambition with this? Or where do you want to see it go? Do you want it to grow?
I guess that's a pretty... I mean, I've got a little bit of that crusty local in me. I think everybody does.
Yeah.
You know, you've got this magical thing. You want to hold on to it. And you want it to be less crowded. And you want it to be cooler. And you don't want to get cut off by somebody who got excited about the Olympics and surfs and has no etiquette and didn't grow up. And, you know, there's all of that. But I think things grow no matter what. It's kind of like, you know, I grew up in Santa Cruz. And it was paradise as a kid. I grew up in Pleasure Point. We had the place to ourselves. Right, had the run of the place. We live on a point break. It was like 6 points back to back. It goes onshore double wind. It's offshore on the other side. Place is amazing to grow up in, right? It gets overrun by dot commers and longboards, and you can just get more bitter and more bitter and more bitter and wax cars and get resentful, and it just change just happens. You know, we don't have a lot of control over it. Surfing's gonna get bigger. You know, you can't all of a sudden just say, don't get bigger surfing. It's going to happen. So hopefully the people that are steering it in the right direction. What really drives technology in surfing, the things that make surfing more enjoyable for us, you know, it is the elite level. It is this pushing of these boundaries that makes things better and the experience better for all of us. So, you know, there's always going to be grumpy people, but I think optimism and acceptance and, you know, knowing that things don't just get less crowded, or especially something as cool as surfing, it's just gonna get bigger. There's no way it's not, you know.
Do you spend any time in Santa Cruz nowadays?
Not much, no.
Okay, but you're on the North Shore now.
Yes.
So how long have you been there?
I've been there almost 17 years.
Is that how drastically have the crowds affected your life in that amount of time? Like, because surfing has grown since I was a kid,
mm-hmm.
but I can still always find waves to surf.
Sure.
Yeah. Down the beach by myself.
Yeah.
You know, like, despite mm-hmm. as much as it's grown,
yep.
that crusty grumpy local argument, I don't know how salient it is. I don't really see the effects in my daily life. What do you?
Not really. I get waves by myself
Me
all
too.
The time.
Yeah.
And if you're up early, you're going to get waves. If you're on it, you're going to get waves. If you go to the beach and look out, there's going to be times. And then, you know, surf between the cracks. You don't have to go to the hyped out spots. You know, surfing is more about kind of connecting with nature and getting a few waves with not too many people around. Like, I'd rather surf worse waves with a few friends or by myself than surf great waves with a bunch of people. So there's places you can go, and I am a little sick of the battle and the posturing in the ocean that you kind of have to do. I get a little stale on that, so I try to avoid too many crowded days, but
that's always been there.
It's always been there, and there's so many spots on the North Shore and so many little kind of spots that have enough power to get moving and hit the lip. And so I'm not trying to win a contest anymore, so, you know, just go for a paddle. It's never a bad time. I've been doing a lot of body surfing too, and that seems to be never a bad time body surfing. You're always looking for a different kind of wave than everybody else, so there's tons of different ways to enjoy the ocean. And you know, the crusty local wants to be mad about anything. He's probably pissed off about the traffic too. He's probably pissed off about, you know, whatever else it is. And, you know, he should go to therapy and learn to be a little bit more positive.
Well, I think that argument's actually more salient, the traffic argument, because as surfing has grown, I have seen that grow. It's harder to find parking, certainly on the North Shore, way more traffic. But in the water itself, I don't see it as much.
Yeah, no.
I think the ocean vets a lot of that stuff out. Just waking up early and having the mm-hmm. discipline to do that vets that out, you know?
Yeah,
but
100%. And, you know, if you're surfing places with current
and
hard to find the good wave, you can see 20 people out and they're just lost at sea.
Totally.
You know, so the North Shore is a lot like that. And you don't have that, like Santa Cruz, there's no current. It's this wall of water that comes in. You could just blindly whip around, put your head down on your longboard and start flailing your arms. You're going to catch a wave. Right, you can't do that in Hawaii.
Right.
So it got a little just, you know, they won by just attrition, you know, in the end. Like, it's just too easy, you know. So you got to go, okay, well, maybe I don't surf Pleasure Point when it's 2 foot. I'm going to go surf the beach breaks where I got to drive and I got to hike through this little woods. And, oh, there's my little rip bowl, or up north where people are scared of sharks. Or, you know, there's a lot of surf. You mm-hmm. can find it.
Yeah. Back to the Olympics.
Mm-hmm.
Who are our athletes going to be from the U.S.?
We will know that at the end of this year, they'll be announced. It's the top two women, top two men on the WCT, as long as they are in the top 10 on the rankings.
And if they're not?
There's all sorts of, like, you know, appendix A, B, D, F, and it's all pretty confusing, but it'll go, I don't know all the ins and outs of it, to be honest, but that shouldn't be a problem, of course. You know, there should be two people in the top 10, and if there's not, we'll still get two people in some form or fashion, you know. Cool. They may have to jump through some hoops with the different events around the world, the ISAs and stuff. So, yeah, it's we've been all trying to figure. We had kind of a conference call a couple weeks ago about it. It's a lot of this stuff's been last minute, and you got to think of all the different scenarios. And you know, I stumble a little bit because I don't want to speak exact. I'm still like wary of speaking about it and it being wrong, you know.
Totally.
But so that's kind of. I just want to make. I don't have it in front of me, so I don't want to like just act like I'm super expert. There's a lot of little what ifs and things, you know, to get the 40 people.
Who would your ideal athletes be on the U.S. team?
Well, ideally, before John hurt himself, it was John and Kaloe, which would be sort of ideal for the sport and for the conditions. You know, it would be pretty historic if Kelly was in there. So there's historic, there's who's going to be good in Japan beach break, there's what's good for the sport. There's a lot of little variables in there. I think John and Kaloe would be the best, but you know, there's kind of some. Not sure the extent of what's going on with John, but you know, it was an ACL that he hurt that he didn't get surgery for, and then so we'll see if that's what it is again, and he needs to get surgery now, or if it's a twinge, or so that's all news that's going to come out in the next few days, I suppose. You know,
what about for the women's side?
Well, the women, if you combine Hawaii and the mainland, it's crazy. The race is on. Again, there's what's good for TV, what's good for the sport, what's good for Japan beach break, you know,
right.
and that would probably be, maybe like a Lakey or, who knows? I mean, Coco might be the best woman. Maybe she's not going to make the top two, but you know, like if it's 1 foot, if you look at like the WQS, like Coco and Malia just destroy the WQS whenever they show up in those little waves because they're lighter and on their little mayhems flying around. But my choice would obviously be, you know, Carissa's in there as a multiple world champ, you know, and Lakey's been right in there fighting, and Courtney's been right in there too, so. Probably those three. We'll see what happens.
It's also hard to pick the team that far in advance.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
I mean, things change on a year-to-year basis, and the best surfer in 2020 is going to be different than in 2019. So.
Yeah. I mean, and there's injuries, and
exactly.
And there's bad boards, and there's, you know, funks and confidence issues, and, people have, break up with their boyfriend, or they... their mom and dad, somebody passed away, or there's so much stuff that can go on to where your athlete really isn't in the zone when they show up. But let's just hope that everything comes together. You know, we win double gold and double silver, and you know, that's what we're looking for.
Are athletes paid to compete?
I don't believe so.
Okay.
Yeah.
Is there anything else we should cover on the Olympics before we move on to Jordy and boards? Board shaping and everything else that you're involved in?
Yeah, I think I've been looking at, and there's some interest from one of the senators in Hawaii to build a high performance center in Hawaii.
Really?
And it's just very fledgling ideas at this point, but he potentially wanted to chase some money. And you know, when you say Olympics, people kind of go, oh, their ears perk up. And there was a committee recently kind of established about surfing in Hawaii through the state government. It's kind of looking at surfing like, you know, okay, we gotta use this as a resource to get more tourism and stuff. That's not Waikiki and, you know, selling handbags and, you know, Mai Tais, like a little different way to look at tourism over here. So, and then sort of the dream is to have this, you know, high performance center, but also serving underserved youths and scholarship programs and tutoring and, trying to create kind of this all encompassing sort of, center, hopefully on the North Shore. There's some land out there that they were considering for potentially a YMCA, and you know, but it'd be, it's just an idea at this point, trying to start get the word out there. And you know, there's anybody, any kind of donations and push going that direction, hopefully in the next 3 or 4 years we can start breaking ground on something.
That'd be amazing. I mean, yeah. And obviously there's cues to follow in Australia where mm-hmm. they've built things like that. We don't really have anything like that mm-hmm. on the mainland.
No.
So it'd be wise for Hawaii to kind of, considering the surf legacy in Hawaii, just to stake the claim and legitimize it in a certain way.
When you're hiring for a small business, you want to find quality professionals that are right for the role. And there's no faster or effective way than through LinkedIn Jobs. Your time and capital are precious, and there is a powerful resource that can help you focus on what you're good at and integrate people into your team seamlessly to help grow your business. LinkedIn Jobs has created the tools to find the right professionals for your team efficiently and for free. LinkedIn isn't just another job board. Everyone is already on LinkedIn with their resumes and references, and now LinkedIn has designed a hiring platform to connect you with candidates specifically qualified for the job that you post about. More than a billion professionals meticulously organized to connect people by skill set to help us all advance our position. 2.5 million businesses already use LinkedIn for hiring, and 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. It's that fast, easy to use, and effective. LinkedIn Jobs can help you write job descriptions, filter the right person to you, and give you the tools to help you interview them like a pro. LinkedInJobs.com/surf is where you go to post your job for free. Yes, totally free. That's linkedinjobs.com/surf to post your job for free. Terms and conditions apply.
Yeah, and you know, we've got multiple world champions, like current ones from Hawaii. There's more underserved there. The tour spends the most amount of time in Hawaii than anywhere. So it really makes sense. And there's, you know, there's such an opportunity, so much surf. There's like surf, you know, 9 months a year on the North Shore. South Shore starts to pump. There's wind swell spots. Like you can, you know, it's warm, you know, you know, and people want to go there.
It's an absolute no-brainer.
And also, if you, you know, surfing's the state sport of California now.
Right.
So, you know, it would, that's a pretty good sell considering it 2028 is LA Olympics. And so if you start pushing, hey, we need a high performance center here. I mean, there's big bucks in California that can do something real similar. So trying to create these centers, you know, that really push performance, and people can have these, because there are free resources through USA Surfing and the USOC for these athletes, and so there's funding for this stuff. And the more you kind of, some people can't see it until the stakes are in, you know what I mean, the stakes are in the ground and it's being built, and they're like, oh wow, I want to be a part of that. So you know, if you get a facility going, there could be a lot of non-endemic kind of stuff. You got the Olympic rings involved, and people kind of want to be involved in things that, you know, are high performance and also charity driven and giving back and nonprofit and that kind of thing. So that's sort of the goal, is to see these happen in Hawaii and in here in California, and then if it grows, then you could do it on the East Coast, and you know, start having a more of a standard for training for surfing, because it's all kind of like this training, that training, who really knows, and having the best doctors available for the athletes. And
I mean, having training period is relatively new to surfing.
Yeah,
you know?
Right.
I mean,
yeah.
How much do you think surfing has been, progress has been inhibited by not having proper diet, proper exercise, regimented discipline?
And there's a big side of surfing where you have to spend so much time in the water. How do you just beat yourself up in the gym?
Yeah.
And how does that look? And what is the real way to just, to where you're feeling good when you hit the water?
Like, what's the right balance?
Yeah, what's that right balance? And that's the stuff that hasn't really been figured out. And if you look at some of the sports, it's like they have all their different theories, and the trainers have all these different theories. If you look at, you know, Golden State, all their guys just blew out. It's like, was that a coincidence, or was that the training that they're doing or not doing, and the recovery or the word that they're getting? And so, you know, even though basketball's training has been around forever, you know.
Yeah.
It's this moving target of trying to find, like, what is this standard that really helps the athletes, that keeps them injury-free, that makes them more explosive. And, you know, surfing is very different. So I think if you, maybe not as hard, but if you trained similarly to, you know, gymnasts and things, and that explosiveness, that type of thing, flexibility and movement combined with coordination and explosiveness, it's kind of got a little bit of everything.
Yeah, interesting. What's your relationship like with Jordy this year?
It's still great. I mean, it's a bummer. Like, I would love to be going to battle with him still, you know. There's, you know, life had other plans as far as me being able to travel as much as it takes to be there for him. You know, we still text back and forth. I don't want to be too involved and kind of making calls from the road. But, you know, when you travel with somebody for a few years, living together, you become really close. And I think we really care a lot, you know, a lot about each other. And we're really good friends. But, you know, who knows? Maybe I'll be able to help him out down the road.
So you're not coaching?
No.
Okay.
No. I was considering maybe going to Brazil, but it's just like it gets tough with the Olympic thing. And having three kids and trying to do two different, and I also shape, so having a board business, coaching Jordy and trying to be head coach of the Olympic team, it sounds like too much.
It's a lot.
It probably is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Last time we chatted was in 2017, when he was sitting in title contention, going into Chopu, where he ended up getting third.
Yep.
And then a second at Lowers, then finished the last three events of the year in 13th.
Yeah.
He finished fourth that year overall, fifth last year, mm-hmm. and right now he's quietly sitting in the fourth spot, but really had a stronger start to the year this year than he did those years.
Yes.
What's your assessment of Jordy right now?
He seems to be in a really good headspace. He's been training. He's eating great. Doesn't drink. Like, he's doing all the right things. He doesn't know extracurricular stuff. He's very focused. And he's just doing the boring athlete things you need to do every day to be as good as he can be. I mean, you saw him do the splits, and he was fine, mm-hmm. you know. And potentially the Jordy that hasn't been doing gymnastica for the last year tears a hamstring off the bone, you know what I mean? So he's doing what he's supposed to do to be an athlete. And I think he's, as a man, he's growing as well, as we all do as we get older. And you know, he's doing the stuff that, you know, all these, ticking all the boxes that can be pretty tedious and pretty monotonous and pretty lonely and pretty boring. And he's doing all those things, and surfing great.
Where do you think his biggest room for improvement is currently?
Luck.
Really?
I don't know. I mean, just, I think, you know, things just haven't, for the last couple of years, things, if you look at what's happened with him, things haven't gone his way, and he still was fifth last year, you know. And whether it was questionable judging calls or really close heats or seeding stuff, you get Slater at Chopu, or you get these, like, things that just kind of go against you, you know. He hasn't, and if you look at the years that people have, like, the right things happen at the right time, and you do create your own luck, but he could. He's back to, you know, he's having a lot more opportunities to do airs this year, which is great. And he made such strides in the last couple years at places like Pipeline and Chopes, and that was a lot of confidence, a few things technically in his backhand parallel riding that he worked on, and then putting in the work at Pipeline. And when you get confident, you choose better waves. I'd like to ask you, what do you think? From just a, because I'm so in it, you know what I mean? Like, I'd like to know what you think.
I think I agree with your thought about he's gotten a couple of bad calls or mm-hmm. bad judging decisions, just poor, maybe like the heat ended up on, you know, at a time of day where he didn't get waves or whatever. Over the years, I have noticed that. Mm-hmm. This year, I feel like he's actually been the benefactor or the beneficiary of the opposite. Like, he gets good calls this year. Mm. He's got two byes already this year because of injuries for other people, you know? Yep. Little things like that where it's kind of like, oh, things are now going his way where they weren't in the past.
I think I always look at, like, you know, there's been some controversial calls judging wise, I think, and that's been, maybe I just look at those kind of, you know, because you always look at the bad things, right? You don't look at the ways, and we always try to say that, like, look, you always, you know, you try to say it's all gonna like work itself out in 12 months. You're gonna get pushed, you're gonna get a little score here that you know that right. You're gonna get pushed a little here, but then, you know, when it starts to kind of go the other way and it's consistently like, wow, do they not like him? Like, how does he not get the nod against that guy? How does he not get the nod against this, you know? And it's hard. I'm not saying these judges, like, they got it easy, you know? And I'm so in it that it's hard to be. But when everyone's just going, wow, and the commentators are going, wow, and I didn't see it that way, and it's just kind of like, all right, we're not crazy, you know? And after a certain time, Jordy gets a little defeated and, you know, just like, whoa, okay, when am I going to get the nod here against this bottom 30 guy? Like, it's almost as if they're making the top guys earn it as opposed to making the bottom guys earn it now. Yeah. Does that make sense?
It does.
You know?
I guess you can make that argument for a lot of different people.
Yes,
you know, I think
100%.
I watched some of the airs, like one of the ones that Felipe did in this event, at the Rio event.
Yeah.
Where it's like, dude, if Connor Coffin would have done that air, they would have given him a 10. You know, because it's Felipe, they don't. But so I think you can make that argument for a lot of guys. But with Jordy, I guess we'd have to talk about specifics. And that heat at Karamas with Jesse Mendez, which was the controversial heat.
Right.
A lot of the internet, Jesse ended up winning the heat.
Yes.
A lot of the internet argued that Jordy should have won the heat. I went back and I watched it and I go, you know, it's questionable. Mm-hmm. But Jordy didn't do all that he could have done on his two scores. He bogged on his two scores, you know.
Yep.
And so, Jordy, you're still leaving it in the judges' hands. Even if the judges got it slightly wrong, Jordy could have tightened up his game and slammed the door.
Yeah.
You know? So I think there's opportunities for improvement with Jordy in a lot of those examples.
Okay. But yep. And like I said, I'm so in it, you know what I mean? That I'm in it. Some people just can't stand certain people and they could never see them getting a score.
Right.
You know? Totally. It's just, and they're like, wait, what are you talking about?
Yeah,
you know what I mean?
So
there's people like, oh, Adriano, that's been the thing forever. I go, I'm just like, Adriano rips. Like, what are you guys talking about? Like, you know? And so it's so biased, and I understand that about myself, and I understand that. I mean, like I said, I do understand, like, there's going to be calls that go against you, but when it's like, okay, that one, like, you know, the world title when he lost to Gabriel at Pipe, and you know what I mean? And, and he didn't get the nod here and he didn't get the nod there. And it's just like, it seemed to kind of pile up a little bit in the other way to me, as opposed to, you know, getting his fair share of those. And it's not like a conspiracy or anything. It's just like, luck, you're going to go to the blackjack table and you're going to get, you know, on a roll, or you're going to get shut down with cards. It just, you know, sometimes it, and you see that happen with different people, and it's really how you react to that, and just keep coming back, keep fighting. Things are going to go your way, and you know, nobody wants John to be hurt. You know, star of our sport, coolest guy ever, like going for a world title, amazing to see him back. But yeah, that was a bit of luck to not have to surf against John in the quarterfinals. You know, and in the end, you go to the finals.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah.
So it's a tough sport in all ways, and so, you know, I don't, it's tricky to really tricky to judge, and I don't envy their position. I would say that, you know, there needs to be at least some sort of focus on trying to improve it, which I don't really see.
Yeah.
You know, as far as from outside, or at least the WSL coming, okay, let's look at this heat, let's look at how we can avoid these different situations and how can we give them tools. And we've already had this conversation, but
it's worth digging into, because the number one thing that they really need to figure out is, you just said, of course I have a bias for Jordy, and some people look at Adriano and they can't imagine him getting a good score. We all do. The judges have bias.
Sure.
The judges absolutely have a favorite surfer that they want to watch. Mm-hmm. And so how can they not be affected by that once they're writing down scores? Mm-hmm. You know, like, it's insane.
It's that's surfing, you know? And it's like, I've worked with kids or so-and-so, and it's just like, oh, that was a close. I was just down at, you know, the U.S. champs, and some kid, he's just like, oh, that kid got the score, and how do you get the score? And I'm just like, it's what you signed up for, dude.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? You want to You want cut and dry, like go be a runner, you know?
Yeah, totally. How much is the notion of too much too soon a real threat and something that brands need to mitigate against when they're chasing talent, you know? Mm-hmm. Like the idea of Brazil, a young surfer coming out of an impoverished area like Brazil and having to work for everything, mm-hmm. and kind of developing that grit.
Yeah.
I feel like talent will get you onto the tour, but the difference between a world title and fledgling in fifth or lower,
yep.
is something unique. It comes from deeper, you know, and it might just be that grit.
Yeah.
So you look at all these examples of million-dollar athletes who don't win world titles, and maybe that's what it was. Maybe when they got the big contract at 15, mm-hmm. it and a team of people making every decision for them and finding the rental car for them and finding the hotel for them and all that stuff, mm-hmm. that it really diminishes that desire you need to win the world title. Mm. And I ask you this because Jordy was one of those guys, and he's a guy who doesn't have a world title yet.
Yeah.
And you've worked with enough kids, and now you're working with youth again.
Yeah.
What's your thought on that? Can you get too much too soon and still develop the world title level of grit?
I guess it just depends on the person.
Does
you
it?
No. I mean, Medina he was nobody, and he won that King of the Groms, and then he was, you know, kind of hailed and was grabbed pretty young, and he still is. I think it's just rare. Any kind of world champion is going to be a rare person. I think they're not made. I think they're born, you know. And there's circumstances. There's circumstances in there. And I think, I mean, you would see it in any sport. You see it in basketball. You see it in these different sports, that the money does sort of, you know, maybe take a little bit of that fire off some people, you know, and it would in the end. So, yeah, it's like, it's hard to really say what it is that gets people those world titles. It's definitely something special if you look at the list of people, you know, but the one thing they do have is like burning, I'm going to kill you desire. And whether they outwardly show it or not, they're doing everything they possibly can to win that contest. And I mean, Medina is just a beast.
Yeah.
As far as that goes, he has, you know, desire to spare. He could probably loan some out and still win world titles, you know.
It's interesting. I feel like that has softened in the last couple of events. Like, mm-hmm. he looked fallible at this event.
Sure.
He looked human.
Yep.
You know? And he has the last couple of events, and I wonder how much of that coincides with exactly what we're talking about. Mm-hmm. The guy has 7.7 million Instagram followers.
Yeah.
Kelly has 2 million, you know, 2 point something million.
Right. Yeah.
So he's just, I mean, exponentially got more kind of fame and whatever in Brazil than in certain parts
of the
world.
And that takes up more time, right?
He seems to be enjoying
shooting ads, hanging with soccer stars. He's this or that. He's, you know, there's, you can get blinded, I believe, at a certain point. Or you kind of, the money's one thing, right? But then when you become famous, like,
The entire country
is like, you're right there next to like the big boys in your country, of a country of however many hundred million of Brazil, and then worldwide he has whatever else, and there's so much passion and so much behind it. I mean, you got to be pretty rock solid and not be affected by that in some way. And it takes your time, and I mean, that intensity is hard to keep up over and over. I mean, how many people go back to back world titles? Not that many people.
No.
That year is like, whew.
Yeah.
And it's like, okay, am I really going to battle for position again and be the bad guy again and get all these posts about me that are just like, I'm this horrible person and robot, and like, or do I soften a little and try to win it this way, or everybody wants to be liked, and so who knows? I know.
Which is why I like Jordy's approach this year, is like, even just traveling to that event, the Rio event, by himself. Just
run,
you know, it's like no pressure, just enjoy it, take it in stride. Be fourth in the world, so not all the pressure is on me, or the target's not on my back.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's smart.
Yeah. It's he seems like he's in a good place, you know, for sure. You can see it in his interviews. You see it just in his you know, facial expressions. I mean, you get to know him pretty well, you know, what I mean? Traveling with him, and you can see that he's mentally, like, you know, confident, you know.
Are you building his entire quiver this year?
I have been, yeah. He's been getting some boards from Darren Hanley. He had a couple he liked, trying some other ones. But we found this new model that seems to have kind of filled that gap that we've had for a while. And it kind of allows him to kind of be Jordy, but also the airs. And that's a tricky one. Find a board that surfs the pocket and goes fast and does airs and releases and holds in. Yeah. Like, you're asking a lot of a surfboard of a 200-pound guy that surfs like he's, you know, he's like a big a big Felipe or whatever, you know. Yeah. There's kind of, there's a lot to going on there. So you just kept throwing, we just kept throwing stuff out there. And this is an old file I pulled up from CJ Hobgood, old file of his from 2008. And I kind of converted over and just threw it out there with a bunch of different other boards. And it was kind of the one that was like, well, there's kind of something there. Hmm. So we started cutting and pasting outlines on it and messing around. And it seems to be working.
Let's get nerdy with the design details. Can you tell me about the model?
It's called the Hovercraft, and it's based on kind of, you know, back in the 2008, 2009, you need a little bit before that, kind of when all the, when Chile was hot and JS was hot, and it's kind of based on the concept that they were kind of running back then. I think some of the American shapers were a little behind at that point. And it's kind of a little bit more of a curve between the feet kind of thing, where a lot of the boards now are a bit, and with a real kind of, you know, consistent, not too much entry, not too much tail. It's sort of like, you know, a lot of the boards now are flat entry, flip tail, or like flat tail entry. You know, this is more of a consistent curve, the whole board. Lighter concaves in general, but a little bit more curve between the feet with like a flatter release. So you can kind of get kind of rock between that curve between your feet, and when you lean back, it's got drive, and that helps give it pop too out of the off the tail, where flip tails are a little harder to do airs on. They kind of, as you can imagine, you know, a little kick tail back there, it doesn't have that pop out of the lip. It's an older curve, and I of course updated it into Shape 3D, and you know, we can make little changes along the way, but still Jordy's outline from the boards that we were using before, because you can do a lot of cut and pasting and messing around, and there's a lot of the software is pretty versatile. So we just pasted an old squash tail outline on there that he liked, and got lucky.
And you apply all those same design elements regardless of size or length?
We haven't had a lot of time to mess around. We were messing around in Hawaii before he went to the Gold Coast and made a thumbtail version of this board, and was like, well, there's something there, but it's a little thin, the nose is a little narrow, and tried a different outline. And we've made some 6'3 round pins that is the same outline as this, the round pins he's been riding. The Wingman 2 was the model he rode last year a lot. And so we haven't kind of looked at, you know, stretching them out into step ups or any kind of 6'6s. We've tried a little bit, you know, okay, with different outlines and things, and haven't. Takes a long time to really test boards to get a really good idea what's going on, especially right when you're right in the middle of a title hunt. You kind of jump on it, and if it isn't just like glaringly magic, you sort of move on to the ones that are working.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I remember him being vocal last year about his feeling that like Surf Ranch creates a distinct disadvantage, mm-hmm, for him just because of his size.
Yeah.
How do you strategize to minimize that disadvantage, both in terms of your role as a coach in the past, but mm-hmm, also as a board builder?
He rode the hovercrafts in the pool, and he said they worked good, both backside and front side. So, and that's, you know, Jordy's one of those understated people, right? If he goes, yeah, stoked, the board works pretty good, that's like, you nailed it. You know what I mean? He's never going to say, magic, oh my God, this board gives me chills up my spine when I, you know, like, right. He's very understated. So if he says it works good in the pool, stoked, that means like he can do what he needs to do. I think they went a little too barrel heavy in that event. And if you didn't just perfectly ride the foam ball and get deep and come out, like, you weren't going to get a score. And it's just like, well, you know, that is a bit bias in that Keanu Singh is going to be a, you know, have a lot easier, yeah, time of it than Jordy is going to.
Right.
I think this year they understood the pitfalls of these long rounds and judging from the beginning to the end and trying to, you know, Jordy, he did get, well, from his opinion, I wasn't there, you know, but he said he got some pretty small lefts. He you know, you can get bigger ones, you can get smaller ones, however the water's sloshing around, however it works, if it's going one way or the other, if it's moving with you, the slosh, instead of against you, and you know, there's ways for this thing to jack up and have more power and those kind of things. But I mean, he did fairly well. It's just, again, you know, little judging here, a little bit bigger wave there, you know, they kind of realize, I think, you know, they'll judge it, they'll have a better idea of how to judge that wave and judge it more fairly going into this year, hopefully. Then of course you just gotta, the seeding, the judging, the waves, everything's kind of, yeah. There's little things can go your way, little things can go against you, and that's the difference, you know, between winning or placing high and losing early, you know?
Yeah,
you get Felipe early, it's like
lights out,
good night, you know. Hope he falls, you know. Yeah.
A lot of what I was thinking about in preparation for this conversation is really about, like, I think we're at a nexus for the surf business, quote unquote, uh-huh. where we're really going to see a boom in the next couple of years. Mm-hmm. I just think we are, period. Whether or not it's a bubble is what remains to be seen, you know? But I feel like guys like yourself are really well positioned to benefit from that boom, just depending on kind of how you structure your businesses. Mm-hmm. Through your reputation and your legacy, you could be a super coach if you want to. And certainly now with your role
do I get a cape?
The Olympics.
I've always wanted a cape.
I like it. One of our listeners will design something, I'm sure, and send it. Or you could be an elite level board builder if you wanted to, you know? And, or you could do commentary, I'm sure, if you wanted to. So let's start with boards specifically. Do you want to increase your board building business?
I always thought, like, why can't you be like one of the world's best board builders and not have this giant business? You know, can't you do licensees and kind of monitor that and, you know, be able to shape, you know, the boards that you do shape, you're the shaper of all of them, and you're a designer more than you are. And there's way more of that now, if you think about it.
Yeah, of course.
But even then, you know, they have these, you know, I would imagine Tomo doesn't have to really focus too much on his business, considering what's going on with the Slater thing. He can focus a lot on design and R&D, and that's what's going to really push a shaper to be interested in what they're doing. So I don't have a big desire to have employees and trucks and factories and have that part of my life. I think my personality is I get a little bored. And so to bounce back and forth from coaching to shaping and trying to keep it interesting. So I think I'll just kind of fumble along and be broke and interested.
Keep things small and quality oriented and personal, yeah, relationship oriented.
I'm not
oriented.
Saying, I mean, there's not that many 70-year-old coaches, but there's 70-year-old shapers all over the place. So it might kind of lean that way as time goes on. But for now, I'm not looking to really increase production or get employees or get go shapers or get a factory or have to do all of that. There's kind of a lot going on,
yeah,
with that type of business, and I don't think I would be very good at it if I was still coaching as well. I wouldn't be 100%, and it would probably suffer, you know.
Yeah, I mean, I'm suggesting that you got to put those things in. I mean, if you want to really capitalize on what's going to happen in the next couple of years, mm-hmm. now's the time to build that foundation and put those things in place.
Sure.
But to your point about there aren't a lot of 70-year-old coaches, it's because we didn't really have coaches. That wasn't a viable career path prior.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, suppose. We see 70 and 80-year-old boxing coaches, and that's a lot more athletic of a role than a surf coach.
I'm just wondering if you just sort of get out of touch at some point, you know what I mean, as the sport just gets so advanced. You know, I suppose if you're always studying and always looking at film and trying to update yourself with technique and maneuvers and things like that, you could stay with it. So remains to be seen, you know, for sure. Hopefully I'm, you know, I mean, to have a wood shop and be wood carving and making wall hanger boards and, you know, hanging with the grandkids sounds a lot more attractive to me than being on the road coaching at 70 anyway. But, you know, so I'll probably be that guy, crusty old craftsman.
Dude, by the time you're 70, you could coach via avatar. Like, you, you won't need to be on the road.
Virtual.
You just beam your hologram over.
Yeah, that's interesting. What's going to happen in the next 20 years with all that stuff? You watch Black Mirror?
I do,
pretty wild. Like, you're just like, whoa, the new season. I only saw the first one. I was like, holy mackerel, this is like, because it's all like commentary on like, at least it's like the Twilight Zone with technology, right? Like,
oh, completely,
whoa,
yeah.
Like, where could this go? You know, and if it sounds possible, it's probably going to happen. Whereas when I was a kid, none of this sounded possible.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, that was, you know.
Every episode makes you want to like destroy your phone, delete your Google account,
exactly.
Delete Facebook, like
exactly.
All of it.
Exactly.
It's wild.
Yeah.
Do you have any individual clients that you're coaching now? I mean, you obviously not working with Jordy this year, but do you have anybody that you're working with specifically outside of that?
I've worked with Baron Mamiya for the last few years, a lot of technique stuff, and still work with Jake Marshall. Been working with him for a long time. I do individual like technique sessions with different juniors and amateurs and different stuff on Skype. Haven't been trying to drum up too much of that business, but you know, with technology, all that stuff gets a lot easier. I tried it years ago, and people would send me these files that were too big, and it wasn't compatible. And now your Mac just converts it all to QuickTime, and you know, like, mm-hmm. It, you know, it's way easier to do all that stuff now. So I do a bit of that, and that's fun. The technique stuff's really fun because it's very tangible for the client. Who else? I work closely with Sean Ward, and he's got Eli Hanneman, and we've worked a little bit, and want to work with him more. And so, and then getting more into the USA Surfing and the Olympic thing and being able to help those kids out. I'm kind of looking forward to kind of maybe helping them, you know, reach their potential.
It's a good client list. I mean, Baron Mamiya, Eli Hanneman, those guys are insane. I mean, they are.
I haven't worked much with Eli, but there's this kind of haven't been able to hook up, but you know, being in Hawaii and they're managed by the same person who's really pushing towards it. We were supposed to do a camp and it never worked out, and so it's just like you want to make boards for the best of the best, right? And that's super fun as a shaper. You know, you want to coach the very best. So and you know, luckily Baron lives right down the street from me, and you know, he's managed by a good friend of mine who understands the value I can bring to his athletes. And so yeah, it's exciting. You know, I think Baron has unlimited potential.
Truly.
It's a super raw kind of Andy Iron style kind of thing where it's like, whoa, where could this kid take it physically? He's up to like 180 pounds now, and you know what he does in the barrels and the airs and big forehand wraps and backhand whips, and it's kind of got it all. He's just sort of a freaking bull in a china shop. You just kind of need to get him to weave through the china a little bit better, and he's that Crosby Colapinto kid. I'm not working with him, but I think he's won 4 U.S. titles in a row at lowers, and he's coming on really strong. He's got very mature approach. Those U.S. champs were wild. Did you watch any of it?
Yeah,
there's a lot of really good young surfers that are coming up under the USA Surfing kind of umbrella, so I'm excited to hopefully get a hold of these kids and
cool,
you know, see what I can do.
Is Crosby Griffin's brother, or is it cousin?
Brother.
Okay.
Yep.
What surf media are you following nowadays?
Jeez, not much, really. I'm just super disinterested. You know, I mean, you hear, if you just kind of swipe through Instagram, the things that actually interest you will pop up and you can read them. You know what I mean? But do I go on my Mac and hit websites and kind of fish around anymore? Probably not. No. You know?
You said you're disinterested. Is it because they're not providing interesting content for you at this point? The websites,
I mean,
you used to... That's my question to you.
I don't... It's all a little, it's just not that interesting to me. I'm 50 years old. I've kind of, you know, there's things that do interest me. If there's an interview or something with somebody who I'm interested in, who's a high level athlete or industry person, or, you know, a podcast or something like that, I'll give it a listen. I think I've been more on a self-improvement kind of kick the last couple of years, and I haven't been absorbing, you know, media as much as I have been just sort of trying to learn and grow. So maybe that'll change as time goes on.
You said that you kind of just get everything you need out of Instagram? Which Instagram accounts are feeding you that information? Like which?
It's nothing really specific. It's just more like, you know, it could be something that 20 different people posted,
right?
And then there's a link to this, a link to that, and you can kind of fish your way through it. And I wouldn't say there's anything in particular, you know, any kind of news, you know.
Yeah.
But I mean, the only things that are really out there are Stab and, you know, Surfer and these different things. And some of them are, I don't really want to like watch somebody go surf in Iceland or hear the story or, you know what I mean? It's just not that interesting to me. I mean, yeah. A couple pictures are nice, but you know, it's fun for the people who go, I suppose.
I mean, dude,
and maybe to try to live vicariously through them is what people are trying to do, but
I mean, I obviously feel the same way that you do, just based on kind of the content that I create and the way that it's crafted. I feel like the idea of publishing a magazine and writing a story about people going on a surf trip is so tired. Like, we've read that story four times per issue for 40 years.
Yeah.
Like, it's just done. Nobody cares anymore, you know?
And there can be some award-winning photo that comes out of it.
Of
just
course.
That one photo, you're like, whoa, how's that picture?
Yeah.
But the story itself, you know, the car broke down, it was cold, and we ate seal meat.
Don't
it's
care.
Just like, I don't really care.
So don't care.
Even that's your adventure. It's not my adventure. I don't really...
And even when I get back from a surf trip, I'm not really that interested in telling that story to my loved ones. They ask how the trip was, and I'm like, oh, this, and that, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, it's a but
so the human interest thing, though, like you said, if there's a long form interview with somebody of interest, it is the human interest thing that is what is interesting to me, anyways.
Yeah, intelligent people, high level people, you know, industry people, that kind of stuff. I like that, and that probably just comes with age too. You know, you're sort of
even young people, I think, are going that way.
Yeah, it's interesting with the whole podcast thing and the YouTube thing, and you know, things are. You know, so much more in depth, you know, subjects can get really covered as opposed to these little sound bites and these things that can get you in trouble. And you know what I mean? Like, there's so much of what I've said today that could be taken out of context. You know what I mean? If it were just chopped up in different ways and you were some dick who was trying to like sensationalize something, you know what I mean? So I think it's really taken a lot of that out, and people are kind of understanding that sensationalism is kind of dead. I mean, unless for just the stupid masses that just love it and just like TMZ and freaking, you know, the story about whatever and the princess is cheating or pregnant or whatever, like couldn't care less about any of that.
Right.
You know, hopefully that kind of mind junk food is going to be, as people eat less and less McDonald's, maybe they'll eat less and less of that stuff too.
Yeah, maybe.
Yep.
What's your current relationship like with surfing?
Not that great. I've got this hip thing I'm trying to been dealing with for a while, and got some good waves in Hawaii in June, which is pretty rare, and this direction was really good and it was glassy, and so we had some pretty fun sessions. But I got this thing where I can't really surf 100%. I can still go out and have fun, but I'm gonna get it fixed at some point this summer so I can, you know, be at least as good as a 50-year-old try to be as good as I can be.
So when you were surfing in June, riding shortboards, high performance shortboards?
Or? Oh, yeah.
Okay.
510.
Yeah. Good for you.
Thruster.
Dang.
Geordie model.
The hovercraft?
Yep.
2.0. Is it just going by the hovercraft still? Or?
It's the hovercraft.
Okay.
I mean, it was, didn't really plan on it being the model. You know what I mean? It was just, we threw a bunch of stuff out there. So it was the hovercraft, and I guess it's got to be the hovercraft.
Dude, brand it hard. We're trying to sell boards here.
Try to find me. I don't have a website. I don't have anything.
I know. So how do people find you officially? Through Instagram? DM you?
Yeah, it's CGD Surf.
Okay.
CGD Surf. Yeah, if they want to. Yeah, it's not as if I'm disinterested in making more surfboards. I just know that if I were to really push and push and push and push, I might get a bit overwhelmed and then have to take a trip. And then you come home and you got 200 boards. And it's a good problem to have, but it gets a little bit much as a one-man show. You know, shaving at my house, and there's a lot of minutia that goes into getting a surfboard into somebody's hands. Like a lot goes on, and collecting the money, and so all that business stuff isn't too much fun. But you know, making somebody a board where that makes them happy and they want to go surfing, it's, you know, it's cool, you know, to be able to be artistic, engineer, kind of two brains working at the same time, asking all the questions you need to ask to the client, and trying to get them that surfboard. So it's a fun challenge, and a bit of a, you know, I guess know, surfboards are tough. So it's, you can do this, have your 10,000 boards under your belt and still shape a really bad surfboard. So and I guess that's what keeps you coming back.
Completely.
You know, is that it's not just, you know, if you're making putters or whatever, you know, like you're the world's best putter maker, like chances are they're all pretty much the same.
Totally.
And, you know, only Tiger Woods, you know, on mushrooms can be able to tell the difference, you know.
Right. Totally. Well, Chris Stone, thanks for taking time out of your busy schedule.
It's a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome.
Yeah.
But he was born of this world. He was born of all the mothers and the colors of our brothers and the love that was taught to you by the one they call Jesus Christ. He may not know no rock and roll, and there may not be a heaven or a place of which to send you, but you know in the end it's madness in a song.
Thanks so much, Chris. Everything that we discussed in this episode is, of course, available on SurfSplendorPodcast.com, as always. If you like this show, I encourage you to share it with a friend. That is how we grow this audience. I will continue to pump out the content as long as the audience continues to grow. And I've been saying that for 5 years, and I appreciate you doing it for 5 years, and we have seen organic growth. Obviously, we don't advertise anywhere. We've kind of ridden the wave of social media's growth at the same time. So you helping share it organically and virally has been a really epic combination for us to keep expenses low and then also just kind of connect with the right audience, you know, people who sincerely want to hear these conversations and care. So thanks for doing that. Share it with a friend. You can do it on social media at Surf Splendor. It's an easy way to just tag somebody or send them a post. And then on SurfSplendorPodcast.com, we also have a donation platform set up via PayPal. So if you want to support the show financially, which helps me basically get around to these people, to our guests, and then, of course, secure equipment as needed, that is available, SurfSplendorPodcast.com/donate. We encourage people just to set up a $5 monthly donation. Super simple, and you won't even notice the expense. Thanks to Galley for supporting our Olympic team and helping us figure out what the Olympics will even look like. This is Independence Week here in the U.S., July 4th. So thank you for that. Lots to look forward to in the future for surfing. So this is David Scales for Surf Splendor. I'll be back next week with an all-new episode. But until then, I'm reminding you to get back into the ocean, share some waves, and shred.